Hello and welcome to episode number 5 of The Zach Kuhn Show. My guest today is co-founder of Vagrant Records, John Cohen. While building one of the most iconic rock and emo label brands, John signed acts like the 1975, Edward Sharp, Dashboard Confessional, The Get Up Kids, and so many more. Recently, John has started a brand new label venture called Big Noise Music, and he has just dipped his toes into the Nashville scene by signing country superstar Travis Tritt. Now, I don't want to give too much of the story away, so let's dive in.
Okay, John, we are live on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I really want to start right in the middle of this story. How does Vagrant sign the 1975?
Yeah, that seems to be the predominant, always the first question, no matter what part of the story people want to tackle. The 1975 was just one of those, I guess you would just call it a unicorn. It was like it's always interesting to look at a band after the fact, but when we signed the 1975, at least to us, they appeared so immediate and their potential so massive that, you know, we were sort of pinching ourselves on how we got lucky. But in terms of this unicorn, it defied all logic in terms of the circumstances. Everything just sort of converged. So what happened was my A&R guy, Jeremy Masiak, who's a wonderful A&R guy, I think he's still with RCA, showed me this video of them that was on the internet. It was their video for Sex in their rehearsal space. And I was immediately blown away. Not only was the song super immediate, but the energy between, you know, George and Matt was just so cohesive. I don't know. It was one of those things that was bizarre. Jeremy and I couldn't really believe that it was unsigned, but it happened to have fallen prey to some circumstances in that their manager at the time, I think, was having a hard time getting a deal for them, just because, and I can't remember everything, but I believe he had done a much bigger deal at some point, a major labor deal, and maybe, you know, he didn't want to do that again, and he ended up releasing it on his local label called Dirty Hit in London, and we had hit it off with Jamie, and I think Jamie respected Vagrant. And it just became one of those things that two independent-minded companies were really psyched on it. And, so we sort of just snuck under the wire, really, before it blew up. And then it blew up very quickly after we signed it, leading into South by Southwest, which was just an absolutely insane situation when they played there.
Could you not believe it was unsigned because it already had traction, or just because you just thought the music was so incredible?
No, it didn't have any traction yet. In fact, I can't even remember if we released anything, or maybe Jamie had something out. It certainly hadn't taken off. No, just because the music was so incredible. I mean, again, I was only going off of one song, being Sex. There was just something so genuine about the chemistry between, and I think in the rehearsal space, I can't remember. Yeah, I think Ross and Adam were in there, but it was really between George and Maddie. I don't know. There was something so authentic about it, even in its infancy. And I later found out that those guys had been playing together at that time. Maybe they were 19, 18. They'd already been playing together for 5 years. So I think that's probably what was happening, just to see how cohesive they were. Short answer, it was not because it was blowing up. It was because it was so magnetic, I think.
I feel like with the 1975, there's such a feeling of almost controlled danger, or a little bit of, kind of excitement breaking the rules. And if you look back at so many bands that maybe influenced early Vagrant bands, like The Clash or maybe the Sex Pistols, there's so much danger kind of surrounding those bands. And when you look sort of into the history, you can actually see that a lot of that was in many ways kind of manufactured by the managers or the teams or whomever. With the early 1975, was there a little bit of that bad boyness already there, or did that start to come as the band would develop and the fan base would grow?
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, and at least my experience with bands that we've had that have been successful, a lot does come down to management and the camp bands have around them. Matt, Maddie, and George, like any good musicians, well, I would say just like, I mean, again, I'm putting them in rarefied air here, but I did, you know, and again, not flash forwarding to when I heard more music, but, you know, there's always been, you know, whether it's Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey, or it's, you know, Keith and Mick, or, you know, obviously the Beatles, I mean, you know, they were all involved, and George was sort of maybe more instrumental in some cases, but it's always like, you know, John and Paul. Maddie and George in the 1975 were very meticulous in and of themselves in plotting their imagery, the way they wanted to put music out. But I think it was equally as matched with great management from the get-go, which was Jamie Oborn, who's a friend and has just done an incredible job managing the band, his own label, and was just as instrumental as I'm sure a lot of great managers were in those early bands. But so it was really a combination of great management and very proactive, keen-minded band members, in this case, from the get-go.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. So you're from California, and Vagrant, especially in the early days, was really known for being an emo band or an emo label. Were you listening to that kind of music growing up, or punk rock? What were you listening to when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, growing up is relative. When did we start really discovering music? I guess 11 or 12 or something. Yeah, my brothers were always into classic rock, and I definitely liked that, you know, from Led Zeppelin, you know, wide range from the Stones to Zeppelin, you know, is varied to old Yes and Queen and things like that. When I got really, you know, 11 or 12 and got into junior high, it was definitely punk rock and, you know, sort of left of center music. I mean, there was the straight punk rock, the California punk rock, and then, you know, like the Discord punk rock. You know, and then there were bands like the Stranglers that were one of my favorite bands from England. Listened to them religiously. So, yeah, it was really punk rock that led into, and with my partner at the time, you know, he was also into punk rock and, you know, we converged. I mean, Vagrant was later. Vagrant came together when I was out of college. But in junior high, it was definitely punk rock. And then the early days of Vagrant, when I met my partner and we got going, it was definitely the new, you know, bands like Rocket from the Crypt and, you know, more punk rock music, definitely. And then it sort of, by the late 90s, what really tipped us into the emo world was my partner at the time was managing a band called the Get Up Kids, and they were going to do a deal elsewhere, and it turned out, you know, that deal fell through. So that began a long series of bands that my partner managed from his management company that he would give the option of where they wanted to sign, and it just usually would sort of tilt over to Vagrant. And that was really what formed Vagrant, at least part one. We had an early punk rock compilation called Before Your Eight.
Of course.
What was it called? Jesus Christ, I can't even remember.
Before You Were Punk.
So yeah, that was
like
our
first. Who's the kid on the cover?
What's that?
Who's the kid on the cover of Before You Were Punk?
Oh my God, that's so funny you mentioned that. Actually, that kid, I don't know. It's a blend. We sort of blended it out, but Before You Were Punk 2 was a guy named, I think, John Halperin that ran. We actually got sued He ran, what was it called? Chain Reaction, which was a punk rock or, you know, like a venue down. And we used his image, but apparently the girl in the Before You're Punk 2 compilation was an old girlfriend of his. They had a falling out. She ended up suing us for using the image. She was like a teacher in Oregon. I mean, it was ridiculous. But yeah, so, but the first image, I can't remember. But anyway, we, you know, that was like a punk rock Face to Face was the first band that we worked with. But what really happened was when the Get Up Kids signed to us in 1999, that really sort of tipped the domino into this emo, you know, emo and then kind of screamo, you know, bands like, you know, or more punk rock like the Alkaline Trio and things like that. But it was really the Get Up Kids, Saves the Day, Dashboard Confessional, The Anniversary, the whole Lawrence, Kansas scene, which was through the Get Up Kids. So that's what really happened there. So it was punk rock and emo into the new phase, which really sort of kicked off, you know, probably like 2006 or something, 2007.
Okay, I want to go back for a second. How do you meet your partner, Rich Egan, at the time?
Well, Rich is one of my closest friends out of college. So we met, I mean, we knew each other vaguely. We're both from LA. We went to different high schools, so we knew each other briefly. But we really kind of bonded when we were both, when I got out of college and he got out of college. And, you know, so we knew each other for a long time.
Okay, so you're putting out 7 inches and then you put out Before You Were Punk, and if you're listening and you're not sure what that is, it was basically 90s artists, punk bands that were recording new wave music from the 80s. So I imagine there was a certain level of licensing that you guys had to do. You had to figure out distribution. How did you figure out all those things? Because nobody, also every artist that was on the EP was signed to another label. So I'm assuming you had to navigate some legalities there. How did you guys figure that out?
Well, you know, that's funny. That's Before Your Punk really became sort of a divide and conquer, where I really learned a lot about the business of music, DIY, very much in a punk rock element. So we what happened was Rich, to his credit, really curated everything and had a relationship and reached out to managers and bands. And at that time, I think a lot of those bands, I can't remember who was all in the lineup. I mean, Blink 182 was definitely the biggest. And I don't know if they had signed yet to Columbia or wherever they were at. I can't remember. But we had a relationship with Mark Hoppus, who now obviously I know very well, and did his record when I was at BMG, their last record, or the record before this last one. But what happened was Rich reached out. We secured you know, agree. It wasn't quite like the urban world is today, where you've got so many side artists and everything. You know, we got approval. We agreed on a royalty that we divided up, and that was really where my crash course in business came in around 1996. What happened was we had sort of anemic distribution prior to that compilation, and then Caroline, which was really the big independent distributor at the time, not the Caroline today that goes through Universal. It was, I think, through Virgin at the time. But they were the big, hot indie distributor. And because we calculated putting all these big bands on, we knew that would create a real catalyst for the label and would be a selling point. So they immediately, and this is probably, it's probably the most impactful time of my life. I'll never forget that that moment. But this was really what launched Vagrant. Caroline said, yeah, we want to distribute you, and we want to take 30,000 copies immediately. And that was like, I mean, neither of us had a pot to piss in. My partner was becoming a successful manager at the time. I was waiting tables and sort of just running the label. But this really kicked everything into gear, where it was like, you know, we did invoicing in a very basic and crude fashion. It was literally $7 wholesale to Caroline times 30,000 was $210,000 due in 60 days. And we were like, we didn't have anything at that point. We'd borrowed money to put things together. We're like, oh my God, this is crazy. And so like, I just learned about invoicing. I got, like, back then when there were record stores, I got a store list from someone at a major label of all the stores in the country. I just sat in a room with a telephone and started cold calling every store, sort of augmenting the sales reps that were at Caroline, sending out display boxes, you know, just very DIY because, you know, we had something to sell. So it kind of excites you and you're like, okay, well, how do I sell the most of it? And it ended up being really successful. Like we got a reorder right away and suddenly you have money, you know, when you get money into a company that really has almost no overhead. I mean, we had a small office in Santa Monica that was probably like $200 a month and a phone line. And back then I think the internet was just coming around. And we, you know, that's always a good, that's always the best way to start a business is when you have no costs and suddenly you have money coming in because then you can move from there. Starting the other way around with a 5-year plan and having high overhead and trying to make it work is, you know, I'm in the middle of that now, but it's going very well. But that's the other way you start a company. So it was great. We were both hungry, and I learned very rapidly about distribution, you know, really business affairs, negotiating contracts with our outside lawyer, and, you know, about manufacturing and marketing. And, you know, we had every zine around and new ad rates. And, you know, you'd create a database and you go, okay, I'm going to take an ad out in, Christ, I can't even remember the names of these zines then, but there were dozens of them from Flipside to, oh my God, it was unending. I mean, I can't even remember from Thrasher to like, you know, you would take out ads and you'd create a marketing budget. And that's basically how it worked, you know.
Were you surprised that it took off so quickly? I mean, you basically, so just to sort of get it straight, so you're taking out ads and the product just pretty much connected almost instantly with the audience?
You know, back then it was about price and positioning, you know, and we had big names on this, and that was the smartest thing. And Rich, to his credit, really curated. He called in all his favors to get really the biggest bands in that genre at the time. So, you know, when you had a machine like Fat Records that probably had 4 to 6 of those bands, and they were really what we modeled Vagrant after, the way Fat Mike would pay royalties and do it very methodically, but very cleanly. And yeah, back then it was about price and positioning. So what you really had to do was if you called the store, I mean, it wasn't about social media, you know, like if, you know, now if Blink 182 between Travis and Mark and Matt had, you know, have God knows how many millions of followers and they send out messaging and, you know, you raise awareness. Back then it was about how do I get my CD and visibility? How do I get up store posters? How do I position this? So, you know, I believe if it was for Before Your Punk 2 or Before Your, maybe it was the first one, we created display boxes. So if I sent out some CDs in a display box to stores, hundreds and hundreds of stores, and you sticker, you know, the CD saying featuring Blink 182, I mean, Christ, I'd have to see the, I can't even remember who was on it, Rocket from the Crypt, Lagwagon, whoever, you know, you would sticker it, and those were the big punk rock bands, and people go, holy shit, what is this thing? I want to buy it, you know, and that's what you did. You sent out posters and POP, you know, point of positioning items, and yeah, that's how it worked.
So that's running, and then, of course, you decide, okay, we got to get into the original band business. We need to be controlling the masters, that whole thing. The first album you guys put out, was it by The Boxer originally before the Get Up Kids?
Yes. Boxer, I think it was called The Hurt Process. So those guys were from Boston. Actually, I'm trying to remember his last name, Jeremy, who was in the band, a guitar player, ended up becoming my assistant for a while after Boxer broke up. He came in. Actually, we've had a number of bands and people that work for Vagrant. But this guy, Dave Vicini, really talented guy, I believe that was his name. Yeah, The Hurt Process was this amazingly talented band. This was really working something from scratch. And, you know, we did everything we could to get him a van and get him out on the road. And, yeah, but the Boxer was, I think Boxer was, well, actually, you know, there was a compilation before Before Your Punk called West by North South, and that was an amazing, if you can get your hands on it, God, it's probably on eBay somewhere, but that was a box set of 7 7-inches that had front and back, like, God, did we get Jawbreaker for that? It was like Rocket from the Crypt, Jawbreaker, Hagfish, Lagwagon. I can't remember, but it was amazing. And then nothing sold like Before Your Punk is really what we say is that, you know, like the first release. And then Boxer was the first band release. Yeah. That was the first.
Okay. So you guys decided you want to sign the Getup Kids. At the time, they kind of had a little bit of buzz, right? Like, you weren't the only label that was competing to sign them. And your family actually, your parents mortgaged their house to sign the band. Like, what was the conversation? How did that happen?
You know, honestly, the details get blurry on when I went to my parents, you know, and again, mortgaging the house is, you know, whether it's in the form of a credit line or whatever the hell happened. I don't know if that was actually to make a face-to-face record. I think we did a live record with face-to-face before the Get Up Kids. You know what I probably did was, and again, I don't want revisionist history, that did happen. There were three sort of key releases that might have revolved around. The Get Up Kids did have a buzz. They were on a label called Doghouse, which is run by Dirk Hemseth, who's still very much active in management and actually works with my ex-partner, Rich, now. They're partners in their own company. But he ran Doghouse. 4 Minute Mile, I believe, was just coming out, which was there was Red Letter Day and 4 Minute Mile. 4 Minute Mile, I believe, was an album. Red Letter Day was an EP that we got involved in. And what happened was they wanted to move to a bigger label. Not that we were that much bigger. But I think Rich was going to bring them to an imprint of a major. And that ended up falling apart, and he brought them to us. In terms of the mortgaging of the house, that money I might have pitched. I think Rich and I probably went out to dinner with my parents and just basically said, like, look, this thing is actually starting to take off, but we have some cash flow issues. You know, I'm sure what happened was maybe we had Before Your Punk coming, you know, like proceeds or money from distribution revenue was coming in. And at the time, Face to Face maybe wanted to make an album. That's probably what happened. And we probably went to them to borrow the money. And I think what we ended up doing was giving them a small piece of Vagrant. And they lent us the money so that to help us with the cash flow. And yeah, so it could have been right around, I mean, 97 was when Before Your Punk came out. The live album was 98. I think Something to Write Home About was 99. So somewhere in there, because of cash flow, we went to them to, you know, sort of double down. I mean, everything's a gamble, but these were fairly sure bets. I mean, I shouldn't even say that. Yeah, I mean, Before Your Punk might not have sold. Face to Face was a staple big punk rock band that a live album we could benchmark would sell something. And the Get Up Kids were buzzing. We didn't know that, you know, Something to Write Home About is such a brilliant album. You know, we just made a great record with, and so somewhere in there, yeah, we had to borrow money.
Do you remember what you paid for the Get Up Kids first album?
I honestly don't remember. I think we made that record with Chad Blindman, who worked a lot with Trevor Keith from Face to Face. And Chad, so I know we made the record from top to bottom. What a record cost back then and how we made it, I'm not sure. And whatever advance, I mean, God, I don't know back then. You know, it's tens of thousands of dollars, I'm sure, but it's not, you know, I mean, it's hard to say.
Okay, so you create the record and you put it out. It's such a great record. I mean, from the double pick scrape at the beginning, you know, it blows your mind the entire way through. Did it take off right away? How did you guys promote the record?
So going back to that record cycle, well, you know, back in the day, we made videos. I'd have to go back to see how many videos we made. I think Dottie, I'm a Loner, was this great video we made with Matt. I think it was like a phone dangling from the center of, was that that record? Yeah, I believe it was. And what happened? Well, back then, you got to remember, just as touring helps record sales today, the way you kind of benchmark the things would get on our radar was from touring, right? So I'm imagine, and I'd have to go back. God, I had that tour poster on my wall for a long time. You know, I think the band was selling tickets and selling merch. The way you could really tell if a band was really important and people were really owning the band was through merch sales. So, you know, and we would have that information from Rich because he managed the band. So if they were doing X amount of dollars ahead in merch, you know, or maybe that's what led Rich in even well before our album came out, seeing the buzz that was going on the road would really help sell records because this was not a radio-driven process. And, yeah, I mean, there was non-com radio in college and everything else, but we, you know, didn't take this alternative at the time or anything else. It was really the road. It was the buzz about the band, how good they were live, how good the music was. I mean, very few things have changed over time except, again, the delivery of how people consume music, what you do, you know, between social media and everything else. Those are obviously the new marketing drivers. They're not new. They're old now, but those are the primary ones. You know, given what's going on in the world now, it really sucks mainly for bands and their livelihood more so than promotion for a record label. But you definitely take that off the table for the record label as well. I mean, one of our bands, you know, The Used, was going to go out with Blink 182 on a huge tour. The Used is, you know, an established band, but that would have been amazing for their new record that comes out tonight. You know, but that really drove things back then. And we would look at bands based on the reports we were getting from the road or checking in with some of our distributors. And we had tons of distributors. It wasn't just Caroline at the time. There were all these networks of independent distributors. And we would get reports, like I would get reports from, God, it's funny. I think that's how I tipped off Kevin at the time, who was a great A&R guy who came in and was our first hire, me and Rich. But one of the distributors had mentioned to me about this band Saves the Day. He just couldn't keep the CDs in stock. And I brought it up to Kevin, who checked it out and went out on the road and saw these guys and like, oh my God, these guys are unbelievable. And that was our next signing. That's how you found out about how many CDs were being sold through independent distribution, how many bands, you know, what bands were selling on the road merch and CD-wise. And that was really the barometer and how you promoted records, you know, unless you were going to radio, which we really weren't.
Hey, everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. Really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
Okay, so you're moving on. Eventually, there's the Vagrant American Tour, which is buses. You know, you're taking your bands and you're going on the road. And the one thing that's kind of interesting about that tour is it was actually sponsored by Napster. So how did you guys team up with Napster for this run? Obviously, at the time, you know, they were kind of like the devil in the industry. Did you guys see them that way? Like, how did that partnership come together?
Yeah, I think that raised a few eyebrows, and Rich was the architect of that. So Napster came in and single-handedly, you know, decimated the industry. I mean, we're just recovering from a 20-plus year recession, right? So that all the domino there was from Napster in 98 or 99. And I think Rich, in the punk rock ethos sort of contradictory method that is his madness at times. So, you know, he thought, okay, you know, let's raise our middle finger to the industry and have this disruptor, which was probably his intent, be aligned with a disruptive sort of punk rock brand like Vagrant, or whatever you would call us. I mean, we were emo, but, you know, it's all grounded in punk rock or whatever. So I think that was the intent. Now, I don't recall Napster giving us much money, if anything, because that tour, as grand as it was, and it was a really, really special tour, you know, we spent a lot of money getting that we never got back, you know, promoting that tour. But yeah, with Napster, you'd have to ask Rich, but I imagine it was Rich's sort of counter-industry fuck you by doing that.
And were you guys booking those shows yourself, or were you teaming up with promoters? Like how did that tour structurally come together?
We had a very good booking agent who was involved with many, many Vagrant bands, called Andrew Ellis. He's still a big booking agent. I think he's with APA, I'm not sure. But he, I think Andrew put that whole thing together. He booked a lot of those bands, if not all of them.
Okay, so fast forward, you know, Vagrant starts signing bands like, you know, Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros and the Hold Steady and the Eels and French Kiss, and you start getting away a little bit from, you know, the emo roots of the label. For example, like a band like Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, which seems, going back to the early Vagrant history, like it couldn't be more of a polar opposite. How did you guys start to sign bands like that?
Yeah, well, that's funny. So there's really two waves of Vagrant. And, you know, it would be a very fascinating book because it's filled with high drama and close calls to a harrowing degree, if anyone were interested in reading the book. But basically, Rich and I were very close and had you know, very tight relationship. And, you know, what happened was for Rich also ran a very successful management company. And at some point he decided, hey, you know, and this was, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in between, but we had a 5-year partnership with Interscope. This was when Jimmy was running Interscope and he was very interested in Chris Carrabba and was all about Chris. And so, That was very harmonious for a while, and then after a while it sort of petered out, and we were coming out of that, and the industry was really getting hammered, right? This was like 2007, you know. So you're 7 years into a recession and a shrinking business, and I don't know how long you want this story, but basically, as the industry was cratering, and I think Rich was pulling more towards management, he was pulling more away from the label. And we sort of divided, you know, Rich really kind of bailed out of Vagrant at that point. And Rich was definitely the driving force up to that point creatively. And what happened was, you know, we sort of had a difference in me saying, look, I see opportunity here. Rich was kind of like, let's just get out. I'm going to go to management. He moved to Nashville. I'm like, well, I don't know. I kind of see some opportunity here. So I just sort of took over running Vagrant from about 2008 up until I sold it. And along the way, my personal music taste and just seeing what was going on with the Warped Tour kind of scene and everything else moved a little bit away from that. And it really, what happened was it really coalesced around two bands. One was Black Rebel Motorcycle Club that came my way. That was coming out of a major label deal, and that was more rock, kind of into my roots a bit. And Edward Sharpe, both brought in by a colleague of mine into the company. And the Edward Sharpe thing was like, holy shit, what is this? Like, the closest thing at the time, maybe just by size of the band, was, you know, the Polyphonic Spree. But, I mean, sonically, this was a lot different. And when we went, and at that point, Rich and I weren't really, I was just running the label. So I brought my, you know, I had a close cadre of people still in Vagrant that were close to me. And we went to go check out Edward Sharpe. And I remember that first show was like 3 in the morning, somewhere. God, where was that place? Anyway, it was mind-blowing. I was like, oh, my God, this is the real deal. I couldn't tell if it was real at first. I mean, I knew about Alex Ebert, and he was an I'm a Robot and very artistic. And I'm like, well, wait a sec. What's the kind of this rebirth? It was like this very new age, hippie, you know, whatever. I went to see the show, and again, kind of like being impacted like the 1975 years later, there was a genuine harmony between these band members and the music and what was coming through. And I'm like, holy shit. Plus the album was just incredible. And yeah. And so that really sort of tipped the domino to the new sound of Vagrant, which again became more deliberate, as I was doing it, just as Rich probably was back in the late 90s, early millennium in curating the roster around what our sound was. I was ferreting out more things like PJ Harvey or, what else did we have? I think we had Evan Dando, the Hold Steady, you know, more of an indie rock vibe. You know, we certainly were never going to get the credibility of the true, you know, like Merge and Saddle Creek and those guys, but I don't think we were really after that. I think it was just more sonically a different sound. And yeah, and then I sort of, you know, I changed it and changed the logo, you know, just kind of changed the look to Vagrant a bit, and sonically it became different. And yeah, that's how that started.
When you heard the song Home by Edward Sharpe, did you know it was going to be such a gigantic hit, that song specifically?
Home? I mean, again, everything was relative because we weren't really a radio-driven label. Home was such a magical song. We knew that that was the quote-unquote, whatever you would define it, Home was going to be the biggest song on the album. There was something, the alchemy of Home between Jade and Alex was so undeniable that we knew that was quote-unquote the song. And actually, at that time, I worked for a minute with Universal Republic on that because, you know, even someone like Monty Lipman, who is a huge promo guy, he heard that song. He's like, oh, my God, this thing's a smash. And so we did some kind of wonky deal with them, and those guys are great for what they do. So for a minute, we were in the Republic system working this or helping us with radio. But what happened with Home, we knew it was going to be a massive licensing song, and it was, and it still is, apparently. I mean, I don't own the master. It was always a license, but I don't. It's in control of the old BMG where it is now. But it was gigantic licensing song. And again, like all great bands, whether it's, you know, Dashboard's Magnetic Performances Live or the 1975 or even, you know, in their own right in a different way, Black Rebel, you know, the live show was so unique and so crazy. This was the first real, there were two really kind of landmark South by Southwest in my mind. Edward Sharpe was the first one, and then it got absolutely dwarfed by the 1975 that year, the year they went to South by. But there were definitely, those were like landmark things where the live show was so incredible and the music so incredible that I remember Jeff Travis, who runs Rough Trade, the only band he signed that year out of South by was Edward Sharpe. So we did a licensing deal with him in Europe. And that was a very credible look for us and was great. Yeah. I don't know if I...
Okay, there's so much we could talk about with Vagrant, but I want to be sure we fit everything else. And so you decide to sell the company to BMG. How did you make that decision? Because I'm sure the company was your baby that you built from the ground up.
Yeah, I mean... Candidly, and always, always along the way, no matter what kind of state we were in, whether we were fighting through lawyers or not, I've always, you know, even at that point, always have given Rich, you know, credit. We sort of had different journeys around Vagrant. Obviously, Vagrant became mine after Rich left, right? So I really took over and ran it on my own. I think up to that point and from its inception, it was always Rich's baby, you know, and I always recognized that. I mean, to the point where it was very precious to him because, look, he created it from a napkin. You know, he before I was involved, he sketched out the original logo. I remember on a, it was a napkin or a piece of paper. It was a hobo leaning against a tree, and it was awesome. And it was born from him and his passion. And so I think what happened in answer to your question is that when you get into business partnerships, and anyone listening to this or who has been in one, and they turn and they become acidic and they become resentful, it's the worst place you ever want to be. And luckily, Rich and I are very good friends. We emerged from it after all this, but it was a very dark period for me personally. And even though Vagrant was in some respects more successful with Edward Sharpe in the 1975 than it had been, it was kind of eating away at me. And really selling the company for me was a way to end that chapter and gain some new experiences in the music business, like running a bigger label, you know, and getting that opportunity to work at a company like BMG, which was really in its infancy. They were sort of reborn. So it was a new time for them. And I had a number of people I was looking to sell the label to sort of really, you know, I mean, look, Vagrant is a great brand, and I know Rich would at a heartbeat, but, you know, if one could get it back again and revive it, it would be awesome, because it's sort of languishing at BMG. They're not, I don't think they're really in the game of preserving brands, but in answer to your question, it wasn't as much my baby as it was Rich's. So that decision was easier to sort of end that chapter and start a new one.
And at BMG, I mean, you've been, the two of you were owning your company and you guys were two, you know, rock and roll, punk rock entrepreneurs. Now you're at BMG in a bigger system. What was it like adjusting to that system?
Well, that was, you know, part of it was eager and exciting. Another part, you know, was scary for sure. You know, short of going into massive details of where BMG was at that time, it was sort of strikingly not as corporate as you would think at that time, because that company, if you look at the history of them you can look at the history of BMG, it's pretty fascinating, but they basically reformed. And when we got involved, there were two record people there, if you could even call them record people. It was really two bodies just kind of doing service deals. So there was really no record label culture at BMG when we got there. So in some respects, it was just like a much bigger, it was a bigger independent. I mean, they're not a public company. Still aren't. I mean, they're massive, but they're not public. So it was kind of plugging into and having a chance to, on steroids with more spending power, build a new label from the ground up. So it wasn't like going into Warner Brothers or Universal that was this big established corporation with record selling. This was really a publishing entity that wanted to get deeper into recorded music. Now, that being said, there were definitely a lot of personalities and bodies in there, and having to adjust to that was fun and exciting and could also be challenging, you know. But I always looked at it as gaining more experience, you know.
So now you're partnered up in this company, Big Noise Music. It's so exciting what you guys are doing now. How did you first get involved with Nick, the CEO, and everyone over there?
Well, me, Nick, and John Feldman started Big Noise. So this was born from what happened was my 3-year contract was up at BMG. I had been looking around prior, and they were moving a mile a minute, and so we parted at BMG. And at that time, I met Nick through John Feldman, who I think you're going to interview. He's a legendary. Legendary rock producer. He's one of my closest friends. And he had never had a label. You know, he believe it or not, you know, he had broken and made some of the most landmark records. It's funny, we never crossed paths when we were doing Vagrant kind of 1.0 in the Warped Tour world, but John did, you know, landmark records from The Used and 5 Seconds to Summer and every band you can imagine. We later became friends. And he's like, man, I've never had a label. I've never done this. I'm like, well, I'm looking for a new gig. You know, I've got this other thing on the table, but I don't know, man. It would be great to work with someone you love and, you know, do that. And I've, you know, been in a tricky partnership, but John, you know, I felt was could add something and I could really counterbalance it. And he introduced me to Nick, who is this amazing force of nature and energy and considerably younger than John and I. He's 20 years younger than us, but seemed really wise beyond his years. And he, you know, came from a music background as well. He was in a band that was signed to a major for a while. He was a studio owner that had this great little studio in Hollywood called Stars, and he was building this brand new compound. And his core passion was music. And he's like, you know, and he idolized John. I think he grew up on Vagrant Music. He idolized John as well. The Used is one of his personal favorite bands that we just did a record with that's coming out tomorrow. That's incredible. And he's like, fuck yeah, I want to get involved here. And Nick, you know, had some resources and was like, look, I'll finance this thing. I want to be involved creatively. And, you know, that was the end of 2017. So we really formed it in 2018. And we're now, you know, from our first release, still about a year and a half, 2 years old. And, you know, Nick really gave us the runway to do this. And I went out and did a bunch of stuff. We're all sort of in our lane. Nick from a creative and financing end, me from kind of operations and putting stuff together and also signing stuff. I've signed a few things into the label. And John really from making records and bringing bands in. It's been a great partnership. And then one of the things we did, which was really in starting a new label, Nick gave us a latitude. We purchased a very prominent urban label that was up for sale. And so we have a whole urban division, which in this day and age is definitely an area you want to be in. So we have another partner that oversees that silo of A&R. And yeah, it's been a lot really fast. And I think that's the way you have to do it these days, or you have to have a massive hit out of the box. And, you know, it's kind of circles back to my original comment about starting a label.
Is the roster? I mean, the roster is pretty diversified from Ashley Tisdale to Travis Tritt to you know some Vagrant style-esque bands. I mean, was that sort of the point, kind of like what you said a second ago, but just to diversify and then you know have a wide net of artists?
Yeah, I mean, so basically we started in the lane of, yeah, I mean, Ashley was an outlier. That was a relationship that John had. I mean, John is also very, you know, can write and does work with a lot of pop acts. So Ashley was something that we brought in. That was actually the very first thing we released. There's a whole method to this, but basically what the core that John's overseeing is really more things like Arrested Youth, The Used, The Rex, things that are more Vagrant-centric and John Feldman-centric. Ashley was an outlier just because she was looking to do something in between her acting, and that was fun, and that was kind of a one-off thing. So what we did was, you know, I went and we got Commission, which is really the urban side, which has some very big acts on the urban end and has a whole developing element. What we do is we keep Big Noise as kind of a wide umbrella of signings, right? We won't be in the pop game anymore. I mean, Ashley was as close as we came, but it would be everything from the older Vagrant sound to straight up rock and everything else. And then, you know, Commission, which is under Big Noise, stays in the urban silo. And Big Noise is really just a wider umbrella, like a parent label, like any kind of major would be, that has different genres. I struck up a relationship through a very close management friend with Travis Tritt, who in his own way is an outlaw and has always marched to his own beat on how he releases music. He hadn't done an album in a while, and we just liked each other a lot, and me and the manager are very close. And his ethos was right for what, you know, we didn't care that it's country. We've put together a team that can service that and is going to treat Travis like a star, and he wants to release music in an unorthodox fashion going forward. So were just like, well, why the hell can't it fit under Big Noise? You know, Big Noise is the umbrella label. We have different genres, and that's how that kind of all came about.
So you mentioned at the beginning that you feel like you learned the most in those early days of Vagrant when you were figuring out how to send invoices and, you know, distribution and all of those sort of fundamental music business skills. Now that you're starting up this new venture, do you have a new sense of excitement that you had starring Vagrant and sort of learning all those fundamental early skills? Is there a new wave of that now that you guys are starting Big Noise?
Yeah, there is a lot of excitement. I mean, again, anytime you're starting a business, I think no matter what sector it's in, there is, and especially when you get some indication of successes, right? It's different. It's different than being in a bigger corporation like a BMG where you sort of, you have stability and you're not worrying about all those things. In a company, the things that can scare you are also the things that excite you, and that's, okay, how do I stay solvent? How do I, how am I going to pay bills? How am I going to make cash flow and everything? When you sort of get those things answered, the excitement outweighs that in the smaller successes or the developing things that you're allowed to do that sometimes you can't do in a bigger company. Like on the urban side, we have this developing act, Big Javi, that, you know, is tracks at almost 30 million and it's taking off, and that's from scratch. And that brings back the excitement of things like the Get Up Kids or 1975 and watching a band and a brand develop from the ground up. You know, on the rock side, we have Arrested Youth that's amazingly talented. This guy Ian is just incredible, and the Rex, and, you know, so yeah, that excitement is back. I mean, I'm older now, so, you know, I'm sort of a young 51. And I've always worked with people 20 or 30 years younger. Well, not back in Vagrant. I guess they were at that time probably my own age or a little bit younger. Now I work with people 20 or 30 years younger. But, you know, the excitement I like to see in other people, and I like to kind of – it's a little different, right? It's not as punk rock. You know, I have a lot more experience, so it's a little more distanced, but – the excitement is still around the creativity and building a company and having successes, you know? It's definitely there, and I've got two great partners that I get to share that with, and they bring their own, I feel like I can lean on people a little more than when it was just Rich and I and everything had to be perfect, you know? I think having a good network of partners and people really allows you to share the burden a little bit and share the excitement, if that makes sense.
Okay, so right now, like today, obviously the industry is upside down, and there's sort of this conversation that I think that people are trying to wrap their heads around, which is, you know, do we release music during this time or do we push back to a different time, you know, whenever that is, and albums are getting pushed, some are getting released right away. You just mentioned a couple Big Noise artists that are putting out albums tomorrow. How do you decide if now is a good time to put out music or not? Like, what data are you looking at? Like, how do you make that decision for the artist you're working with?
Are you talking about right now because of the COVID situation, or just
right? Right now because of the tours are canceled and everything's so topsy turvy. Like right now, today.
Well, you know, that of course is a bummer, the touring thing. I would only say that as opposed to maybe the early millennium or before social media and, you know, virtual channels of promotion kicked in, or whatever the metrics are, whether it's playlisting or Shazams or all of the tools we rely on today to see how something's performing. When the traditional channels are impacted, like touring and even terrestrial radio and even satellite radio to a degree, I think really the only thing left standing, ironically, after 21 years or at least temporarily of recession is recorded music, because you're not distributing recorded music through physical stores, at least for the most part. I mean, obviously, someone like Travis Tritt will still have a physical record or, you know, whomever. But, you know, and even the download store, it's all now streaming. So deciding when to release something really comes down to the artist and where they're going to focus their resources, especially now since they're grounded. So a lot of artists are obviously raising their hands saying, hey, I want to get out more music. I may not be on the road, but I'm going to be putting my energies towards whatever it is, Instagram promotion, you know, whatever they're doing, you know, their social media campaigns, their all the stuff that they can do online, whether it be, you know, whatever it is, through any myriad, TikTok, you know, their energies, they're bottled up as well. They're grounded. Yes, some go to their studios, their own studios, or they go to, you know, they'll share files digitally, they'll make music, but they're grounded. They can't perform in front of live people, you know, whether they're doing live streams. And we will do, I think we're going to do a Goldfinger record this year with John, but he'll do, you know, we're looking into companies that can do actually an entire virtual tour, you know, that, you know, you'll watch online. So I think when those things come together and you have the buy-in from the artist and they're not putting their energies just in touring, that's when you decide to release stuff. You know, we sort of take our cues from our artists that realize that they don't want their brands to lay stagnant and they're not going to be able to help their brands through physical touring. So they want to release music and they want to create a marketing campaign around that.
So, I mean, you guys went through, you came up at the end of the physical era into the Napster era, and now we're in the streaming era. And I mean, I know the answer is yes, because you're investing and doubling down on it right now. But can a label start up brand new today in the streaming industry and sort of make it work? Like, how has it changed from when you started Vagrant sort of at the end of the physical era and into the Napster era?
Absolutely. I mean, all the same. I mean, again, it's, you know, it's all relative what a label is, right? One artist with his own imprint name is a label, you know. There's companies, you know, my close friend runs Cobalt, right? I mean, Cobalt is a classic platform that they've sort of rejiggered their whole business model from a recorded music end. They're just a set of pipes that they give to artists, and they'll throw on promotion when something looks like it's raising its hand. And, you know, so a lot of artists, you know, choose to release their music themselves, and they're like, why do I, quote unquote, need a label? That being said, I think labels invariably, when you actually become a label, you reach a point where your ambitions exceed your own desire to put up capital, if that makes sense. So in essence, a label now becomes a bank, as it always was to a large degree. And what people you have at those labels, those resources that come baked into a deal with an artist, that an artist might say, okay, well, I'm doing great releasing my own music. Why do I need a label? But I've got X, Y, and Z collaborators I work with. I'd love to put out. They've got a great band. They've got, you know, do I want to reinvest my own money? Do I have the resources? Do I want to hire all these outside firms to do digital strategy and playlisting and all the things that are going to cost money and create invoices, and I'm going to have to cover the cost? Or do I either go to a quote unquote label who's going to cover all that and take a piece of the action? Or do I become a label and double down on myself and reinvest the money I'm making or living on to expand and roll those dice? You know, back when it was Vagrant, we got very lucky. I mean, it was as calculated as it could be, but as I mentioned to you, expenses were very low. It was just Rich and I, me in a room calling stores with one compilation that generated a lot of money that we then reinvested into two or three projects that ended up making money, and we were off. And then we populated our staff accordingly. Now, you sort of have to ask yourself those same questions. It could either be done a similar way. An artist could have its own music or a band, one band, that, and they're called a label and they're generating tons of money. Do they want to invest it back and bet on themselves. It's like being in Vegas, and become a true label, or do they want to stay comfortable? I mean, it's always a gamble. I mean, yes, anyone can start a label as easy as they could when we started Vagrant, which was just a business license, a name, and a project. You know, it's really what's your appetite from becoming, you know, a self-supporting silo with your own music or one project into a wider organism that's putting out more music and taking more risks and more and putting down more bets. Does that make sense?
Totally. Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. I mean, so much amazing history. And what I've always loved about Vagrant is the ability to kind of have both of the main hit, the mainstream music scene and the underground music scene, and remain, you know, incredibly authentic throughout so much of it. And, you know, so many respected bands across the gamut of popularity. And I'm so excited to see what you guys are doing with Big Noise right now, because you look online, the facility looks incredible. Everything looks, you know, so state of the art, so fun. And the roster is just so exciting and so varied. So super excited to see what you guys are able to do within the next couple of years and beyond.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. The Zach Kuhn Show comes out with new episodes every single Tuesday. So be sure to tune in next week. We have a surprise guest, and I can't wait for you guys to hear. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. Special thanks again to John for taking the time to talk. It was such a pleasure. Hope we get the chance to do it again soon. If you want more content from us, you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. And if you want to subscribe to our newsletter, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.